Lend me your ears. The Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Salon. Conversations about sound.
Hello, welcome to The Salon. Our guests today are Julian Henriquez and Andrei Mirchev. Andrei Mirchev is an artist and academic from former Yugoslavia, currently based in Berlin. His interdisciplinary artistic practice engages in possibilities of a critical, dialectical, and intercultural dialogue between theory and practice, and his research interests include spatial theory, intermediality, memory and archives, critical theory, and performance. He is co-editor of the 2019 collection of articles Left Performance Histories and co-author of the visual arts project Red People, Everything Divided. Andrei is a former research fellow of the International Center for Interweaving Performance Cultures in Berlin and visiting professor at the Art Schools of Berlin, Karlsruhe, and the Institute for Applied Theater Studies in Gießen. Julian Henriquez is the director of the Topology Research Unit at Goldsmiths College, University of London, where he also convenes MA programs in scriptwriting and cultural studies. He has worked professionally as a film producer, writer-director, and sound artist, and is a founding trustee of the Stuart Hall Foundation. Julian's research interests include street technologies, sonic epistemologies, and non-representational meaning-making. His academic publications include monographs on sonic media, the street technologies of the Jamaican sound system from 2018, and sonic bodies, reggae sound systems, performance techniques, and ways of knowing from 2011. Julian and Andrei met at a conference in Gothenburg in 2010 and have been informally exchanging ideas and insights ever since. Focusing on sonic clashes across different cultural and media contexts, their salon conversation on this occasion reflects on the oral dimension of affect transmission with reference to contemporary dramaturgical concepts. From a methodological perspective, this conversation is a dialogue between the disciplines of sound, performance, and cultural studies. Locating the point of convergence in the figure or trope of antiphony, or call and response, Julian Henriquez and Andrei Mirchev talk about Jamaican reggae sound system, a Brazilian religious performance in a public space, an attempt to sonically interrupt a choreography in Belgrade, and the ideological sonic warfare between North and South Korea. This conversation took place between Berlin and London and was recorded on Zoom on the 29th of June, 2020.
Hi there, Andrei. Nice to see and hear you.
Hello, Julian. Also, nice to hear and see you.
Okay, so in this strange virtual world, we're having a conversation. Well, we've had many good conversations in the past, so I'm looking forward to this one as well. So I think we should say, I mean, we know who we are, but perhaps it might be useful for the conversation to say who we are in terms of letting the listeners know where our points are coming from. Okay, go on.
Yes. Okay, so I'm Andrei Mirchev. I'm basically coming from an area that could be described or framed as performance and theater studies. However, I have made a few detours in life, meaning that I have been experimenting with also artistic practices, not only discursive formats or theory. Why I'm so interested in sound studies and this whole thing of how do you make use of different strategies of sonification is there was a moment where I realized that the visual information or that all the visual world is reductive, that it keeps you on a distance. And I've been trying to understand, and the specific interest I have developed in an audio walk where I was able to retrace a memory of an architecture by using sound. So in that sense, I'm very interested in this relation between affect and sound. And that's the background from which I'm, in a way, coming from. And the other background is I was interested, and that is one aspect of my research, goes into the question of icons and how a certain philosophy of images can help us to understand collective struggles and, let's say, the cultural clash that is happening at this moment globally. And for this occasion, I was inspired by this idea of a sonic clash. So I suppose we will talk more about the sonic clash and how sound can be used to understand our contemporary moment. How about
okay,
you?
Okay, fantastic. Jim? Yeah, and are you going to play me something at this stage? Do you have an introductory thing to play?
I wanted actually to start with an example of an antiphony, of a sonic clash that I have experienced when I was in Sao Paulo. So this what you will hear will be is a field recording of a performance on a square. It has a very dramatic structure and it is very intense in expression. So I actually could not really understand the meaning of it, but what I realized is that it was actually a sort of a very engaged Catholic performance done not by a priest, but just by worshippers on the street. And it had, if I may say so, a very stage-like character. And why I was so drawn to the sound is because it was very effective in a way. So I will play you a few... So, what was so fascinating about it is that I have actually never experienced such a distributed sonic performance in a way. You had this guy running around in a circle, and as he was approaching other performers or other participants of this performance, they were shouting back, or they were talking back to him. So it had this call and response structure. And thematically, he was referring to the biblical stories. So, and I found it a very interesting way of a effective transmission of something that is very religious in its essence.
Yes. Well, okay. That's very interesting, especially as you kind of give it a context and stuff. And certainly call and response, or antiphony, it's exactly the same thing, is a key trope in very, very many cultures. And the one that I've been studying for many years is the Jamaican sound system culture and technology. And there in the streets, in the open air, you do get this relationship between the DJ, or the MC as we call them, who is chatting on top of the music, and the response from the audience. I'm going to play you something in a minute which is a bit like that. But this whole thing of if you like, of drama and sound, which I was encouraged to think about in the light of this conversation, is a very interesting one for me. Because sound is what I've been studying, and the affective influences, and the what sounding does to our bodies is a very important and deserves proper depth of study, which is what I've been trying to do for several years. And the idea of drama and sound, I think we can start off just literally at the level of the sound waves themselves, you know, because so drama is about conflict traditionally, and I would understand in a sound wave you've got compression and rarefaction, or constriction and relaxation, and that's what a sound wave is. It's an energetic impulse. And so there, in the very nature of sound itself, we've got a dramatic tension between the peak and the trough, which, well, made me think about sound differently. And then in all the forms of sounding, it is very much for me a kind of a dialogical situation, which is exemplified in the call and response. And that's, well, I mean, that's quite a lot of similarities, I think. So let me play you a track. And so, as I say, I've been studying reggae music and sound systems for a long time, and within the form of the music, this is there's a tradition where you have two artists, and they're, if you like, calling and answering back each other. And I've picked many examples of this. I picked a track by the late Tipper Irie, who's a British MC, and Janet Kay. And so here you see a kind of conversation between, or here you hear a conversation between two lovers, where one is commenting on the other. It's a real nice gender kind of conflict here. So let's see if I can play it.
The track now playing is protected by copyright, and we are unable to replay it on Lend Me Your Ears. Please refer to the podcast page on our Auralia.space for full credits and a link to listen. Thank you.
Okay, so there you have it. It's quite a charming, charming conversation in music, but there's a drama there. Just to repeat what the lyrics say, so the guy is off on tour and he expects his girl to be ready there waiting for him when he comes back. And I mean, it's a very, very ancient story. But in terms of antiphony and about a call and response, for me, it illustrates in a very different way what you were saying. That's, for me, part of the drama of it. And of course, but with a crowd in the open air setting of a dance hall in Jamaica, there it's not just a one-to-one, because one party in the antiphony is, well, literally the chorus. In the classical Greek sense, responding to the actor on stage. So there you are. So
Great. I mean, I think I have a good response to that, because I was, when I was thinking, you know, I was somehow motivated to shed some light on maybe something that we could call the genealogy or history of drama, or the history of theater, though we don't know precisely when was the initial moment when we can say, okay, from here now we have theater. Does it start already in Egypt, old Egypt, or is it? But let's say for this conversation, I think I found this initial moment where Thespis, this first actor, was set to step out of the chorus and responded to the chorus. So you have a collective body, and you have an actor who steps out, and they enter a sort of an oppositional relation. They enter into something that we could call a conflict. Or to bring it even further, a step further, I recalled a text which I was teaching many, many years ago, when I actually started my career as a young professor in Croatia. I had a course that was called The Tragic Rhythm of Performance. It was a text by an American performance studies scholar, Francis Ferguson, where he developed this idea that actually in tragedy, you always have this sort of an act of assertion that calls forth for a counter assertion, which in the end produces something of a rhythm. And I was thinking now that one of the possibilities to understand what we have been in the preparation of this conversation named, or came up with the idea of, a sonic dramaturgy, that you could say that it is actually a rhythm analysis of affective circulation, because what it does, it in a way introduces this affective relation, and which is always a response between the audience and the stage. So you have this actually circulation that is happening, that can be understood as a rhythm. And why I think it's so interesting, and I would also say what I think performance, the field of performance studies can learn from sound studies, is exactly this notion of affectivity, this notion of intensity. How do you develop dramaturgies that are in a way enabling a different sort of narration, but also a different sort of call and response that is not only verbal, it is not only text-based, but that it really goes into a sonic dimension, which transmits affects not only as representations, but really does it on a more corporeal level, which is how I read and understand sound studies, I mean, in this acoustic term.
This raises a whole lot of interesting points of departure. I mean, one of them is this emergence from the collectivity, which I think is very interesting and very important, because it gives an idea of the fundamental sociality of our consciousness and of the nature of ourselves as relational beings. Yeah. I mean, sounding itself helps to emphasize that, as you've already mentioned, in terms of not having a kind of visual distance between viewer and viewer and having more involvement. Also the idea of listening, which is not just hearing, the faculty of being able to hear, but actually giving attention. And so with sounding, you've got these relationalities emerge very, very naturally from the medium, you could say. And also, if we take even a step back from that yes, drama is very much associated with speech, but it's also, we have to go back, I think, to look at the origins of speaking, of verbal language, in sounds and, you know, sonic audible gestures, which form the basis of a much broader idea of where meaning comes from, in terms of the intonation and prosody and all the information that we give in how we speak, in addition or underneath what we actually say. And so great, this emerging from the collectivity and the opposition, and then to be able to set up a rhythmic exchange, I think is a really interesting way of considering it. You know, because rhythm as part of the prosody, as part of the speaking, is, I mean, incredibly important to speech, but also to, of course, to music. On the Jamaican music scene, to take another example from there, we have a whole thing of rhythm tracks, whereby the producer of the rhythm is, if you like, is the prime mover on the music scene, and then the different artists vocalize on top of that rhythm. What I'm going to try and, I want to play you something that does that. It's a particular Bounty Killer track, mm-hmm. called Sufferer, and a particular rhythm. Let me see if I can just find it. Oh yeah, okay, I've got it. Okay, so this is a particular rhythm. It's by an artist called Bounty Killer. This is 10 or 15 years old. The rhythm is called Diwali, which is an Indian kind of, or taken as an interpretation of an Indian rhythmic track. And he is chatting a lyric on top of that. So the rhythm, but so have dozens, literally dozens of other artists have also sung or chatted their lyrics on top of this. So let me just play this. It's quite hardcore, as you'd expect from a track called Sufferer.
The track now playing is protected by copyright, and we are unable to replay it on Lend Me Your Ears. Please refer to the podcast page on our rallya.space for full credits and a link to listen. Thank you.
Well, you probably only got one word from that, Sufferer, but you certainly would have also got the rhythm, which we should talk about more.
Yeah. I think I maybe missed to make this sort of a, I don't know if it's a strong claim, but anyhow, I think so far I didn't really come to this point where the beginning of theater in Greece really has this sonic antagonism in its core, which I think could be rethought in light of a acoustic turn that also has to be applied or rethought in the context of not only history of the theater, but also in the context of how do we perform today and what is the sonic or acoustic dimension of performance. Or maybe something that I also found very interesting in reading your colleague Steve Goodman, where he talks about the sound as force, or the seductive power of sound. Something very interesting happened to me yesterday when we were talking about, when we were preparing actually our conversation. I mentioned to you that I would like also to talk about Antonin Artaud, the French visionary, and if you also want, madman of theater. And that was really super fascinating. Until yesterday, I only had this the Serbian version of his text. And yesterday, going to the flea market, I was able to buy a book where... And the first thing I actually, when I took the book and when I started reading it, I actually found this exact place, which I think will shed also light to what does it mean to work with sound in theater, in this performance culture, which he also tries to get away from or to remove from this Eurocentric sphere or culture, if you want. So I will read you just one passage. Artaud says, "The theater is the only place in the world and the last collective means we still have of reaching the organism directly. And in periods of neurosis and base sensuality, like the one in which we are immersed, of attacking this base sensuality by physical means which cannot resist. If music has an effect on snakes, it is not because of the spiritual notion it offers them, But because snakes are long, because they lie coiled on the ground, because their bodies touch the ground at almost every point, and the musical vibrations, which are communicated to the ground, reach their bodies like very subtle and prolonged messages. Well, I propose that we treat the spectators like snakes that are being charmed, and that we led them by the way of the organism to the subtlest notion. This is why in the theater of cruelty, the spectator is in the middle and the spectacle surrounds him. In this spectacle, sound effects are constant. Sounds, noises, cries are chosen first for their vibratory quality, then for what they represent.
Beautiful passage that. My God.
And for me, that in a way totally sums up and also anticipates many of these debates which are currently happening not only in performance studies, but also, I guess, in the field of sound and sonic studies, which also made me recall this whole idea of the futurist performances, which were also about introducing noise as a way to escape representation and as a way to expand the field of what performance can be and how it can actually directly engage and activate sensorially the body, not only of the performer, but also as of the audience. And I quite like this idea that he talks about the vibratory quality of sound and what the spectacle should be, that it actually should vibrate and should, in that sense, enhance this idea of that you are immersed in the spectacle, not in front, not seeing it as an image.
Absolutely. Well, this is, I mean, it's a beautiful passage, and this idea, the phrase is wrote down about approaching the organism directly. And I suppose I don't know Arto's work that well, but I suppose the cruelty is, and is actually to, well, I mean, well, the phrase I use is to go under the radar of rationality and language, yeah, and to get directly in touch with ourselves, with our bodies, with each other, at a more representational or a non-representational, we call infra-representational level. And theatre, I mean, does do that. Good theatre does do that, the immersion. And I mean, and also I have to say that the sound system session, the dance hall session out in the streets in Jamaica with these, you know, these huge speaker boxes, which generate or which propagate, I mean, literally thousands of watts of music power, so you can literally feel yourself vibrate with the bass beats, and the whole kind of experience is deliberately designed to be immersive, not just through the volume levels, not just through the frequency, low frequency levels, but also interestingly, and this will appeal to you, I think, that a conventional, well, just put it like this, that the speakers point into the crowd. They surround the crowd. So you have three or four what we call stacks of speakers pointing in to the crowd in the middle. So it's sort of theatre in the round, or rather sound in the round. And that is, basically absolutely the speciality of this particular cultural technological form. And it also makes a nice contrast with conventional theatre, where or in fact conventional PAs and sound systems when they're used to amplify what's going on stage, right? And there you replicate the proscenium arch and have your speakers basically on either side of the stage. And that, you know, that's good for, so that the focus is on the performer in the conventional way. But when you don't have a performer, because with the sound system, basically, it's phonographic, it's a recording, And so there's no visible presence of an artist there. And so what I like to describe it as is, if you like, the sound itself becomes the material in which the audience have to become immersed, and they're not distracted by the living presence or a visual focal point in the way that theatre or a conventional gig is sort of configured. And so that whole business of getting to people through their visceral immersive experience is, well, I mean, that's an essential part of it, you know, and it's a big contrast. I mean, we're so used to nowadays, we both got headphones on, right, of putting the sound into us, whereas when the sound system dance, we go into the sound. So the whole orientation is completely different. Yeah, or no, not upside down, inside out.
Inside out, yeah. Inside out, yeah. Right, yeah. I wanted to play a track or an example of something that I found very interesting. It maybe moves the perspective or moves the focus on this conflict, on how a conflict can be articulated or how it comes to being through this oppositional rhythm of sound and clapping. I will play you a soundtrack of a protest which happened in 2017 on the occasion of a festival in Belgrade. You had a Kosovo-Albanian artist, Fita Berisha, doing a live choreography and performance in a youth center. But the trick is that you had right-wing protesters that came with an attempt to stop the performance. They started singing patriotic songs with the intention and ambition to defocus the performance and eventually bring it to a stop. It's an ongoing and long conflict between Serbia, this nationalist Serbia, and Kosovo Albanians. And for me, it was a very interesting moment where actually you had the reaction of the audience that protected acoustically the performance, the choreography, so it could be executed until the end, and it protected it by clapping very loudly. So you will hear now how it sounded. Counter performance with clapping can actually ensure, I'm prone to think of it as a sonic protective shield, that it ensures a territory in which a sound wall is protecting the performance to happen until the end.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. But I mean, I would see it perhaps more as in terms of just a sound, a clash between mm-hmm. where one sound is from one side is trying to, well, literally to drown out the other side. Yeah.
Yes. Here it comes. So you hear, I think that what is interesting in this constellation is that you have a sort of a double rupture. You have the protesters trying to disrupt the performance by singing loud patriotic songs. And then you have a rupture of a rupture. You have, which constitutes then a rhythm. A very interesting rhythmicity is at stake here. And I was quite amazed when I actually, at some point, I tried to understand and to reflect it getting back to some positions articulated by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, where I found very useful is their notion of the refrain, where they say that actually singing is a force that establishes a territory. Mm. And here you could also think of a counter rhythm, that actually the clapping produces a counter rhythm, that it produces a, something of a, it deterritorializes this territory that, that, that the singing has been producing. So in that sense, I found it also, again, very interesting to think of a sonic dramaturgy that enables us to really closely examine this conflict, but also this this relationship and feedback between the audience and the and the and the stage.
Well, I mean, this is all very, very interesting. And so if we sort of like take the call and response as one sort of rhythmic formation, right, which is, if you like, from when the actor steps out from the chorus, there's a rapport between them. But then what you're talking about with your example, and certainly what I can talk about with the reggae culture around sound systems, that that is pushed to a next much more conflictual kind of rhythm. I mean, rhythm is so important in terms of, yes, as you mentioned, the territoriality that Deleuze and Guattari talk about, of establishing, if you like, sonic space or sonic spatiality through, you know, which I don't know whether, you know, which, you know, territorial birds, the robin bird, you know, sings their territorial boundaries. And so sound has a spatializing effect, which is very different from the visual, because it's more temporary. It needs to be continually propagated. It needs an embodied presence in order for it to exist at all. With the sound systems in Jamaica, there's a, there is, and there has been for many, many years, this phenomenon, this event called the sound clash, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a competitive situation between two or more sound systems. So you imagine on the streets, you have these set of speaker boxes, at least three for each sound system. Okay, so if you've got two sound systems and you have six speaker stacks up in the road. Yeah. And basically the two sounds take it in turns in sort of like 15 or 20 minute slots to outplay each other. Right. And it's quite democratic in a way, because the at the end of the clash, as it's called, a sound clash, the audience will decide just by their cheers and claps and hoots and hollers which sound has played the best tunes of the evening. And so it's just a device for adding excitement and adding drama, literally drama, to an auditory situation. And the way that they win a clash against the other is by having the most exclusive music to play. And there's a whole infrastructure of technology around that. We have these things called dub plate specials, where a sound system will commission a top line artist to do a special version of their hit song, which mentions the sound system that's paid them to do that, right? And so it's quite an expensive business. And so you'll have your dub plates as kind of like a ammunition in a kind of sonic warfare situation. And the judgment as to when to play which dub plate, which one, it's like playing a pack of cards, which card, which dub plate is going to trump the track that the other sound has just played. So that's quite amusing and actually can turn violent. And so that, so the drama is absolutely central to the musical and cultural experience when it's moved away from the antiphony and it's an actual clash between sound systems. And that's to do with their musical power and their refinement as well as the material. And that's translated at a lyrical level as well, which is kind of interesting, where you'll get two artists who will clash against each other, that they will try and outdo each other in terms of their sort of verbal dexterity, to mix a metaphor. And that's been absolutely essential part, not just of the Jamaican sound system scene, but also the development of grime music in the UK in the last decade or so, where in the pirate radio stations, you've got a whole bunch of artists sort of sparring, as it were, off each other. So let me play you a track here, which is in fact part of a live sound clash that was broadcast online in the last few weeks. Online because of the pandemic situation. It would have been done live otherwise. And between two famous artists, as I say, it's not live.
The track now playing is protected by copyright and we are unable to replay it on Lend Me Your Ears. Please refer to the podcast page on our Rallya.space for full credits and a link to listen. Thank you.
Okay, I don't know if you've got enough of that to get the idea, but two guys basically showing off against each other is a bit of a clash. And so, well, there you have a lot of drama, I think.
Yeah. To this, first, let me respond with this idea, what I also found very interesting. And I think for me, for the topics I am researching at the moment, how we can develop a more visceral spatial theory is this idea that there is a vibrational experience of a city, which those examples, especially I guess in such a culture as the Jamaican culture and the whole system of a public also music ongoing performance on happening on the streets and on the squares, really makes me rethink this notion that you are isolated, that you are in a way an individual, because in this circumstances you become part of a collective body in a way. At the same time, you mentioned it already that as soon as you have this idea of a clash, you could also think of a warfare. You have this resonance of military, of something that is connected to military structures. What I found very interesting is this idea that actually there is a militarization of the audio sphere happening. And if you look back and historically, the idea that the radio was developed in Nazi Germany as a way of mobilizing and as a very ideological tool, you could say, that it also had this military and ideological effect. I was in a way not surprised, but a few days ago, I came across this state of affairs, this tension, this ongoing tension in South and North Korea, where they have the DMZ zone. So it's a demilitarized zone that, in a way, it's a no man's land between the two conflicting ideologies, North and South. And what they have been provoking each other all these years, installing big loudspeakers, systems of loudspeakers, where they actually play to each other different ideological messages, different tunes. So you have an acoustic war happening all the time. So I thought for this conversation, it could be interesting to hear just one such an example. So what you will hear now and what I will play is this very territorial sound that is being played from the loudspeakers. So, and in the end, this strange, I don't know how you would call it, it's a soundscape, but it's so distorted, probably due to this big amount of loudspeakers, turns into a pop song, the intention of which is to convince the North Korean people that the South is offering a better life, or that it offers a dream where you can actually live in a pop song, which I think it's quite, it could be seen as an example of something Goodman also calls the sonic violence, which I think is quite an interesting figure to think that there is a whole violent dimension of sonic cultures or sonic performances, if you want.
I mean, there certainly is. I mean, especially in war situations, and you know, before we had post-traumatic stress syndrome, we had shell shock, right, in the First World War. And it was the term for soldiers exposed to by explosions that had literally a traumatic effect, and that the trauma was such that they couldn't escape from having heard the sound and from hearing the sound and from other smaller sounds that would re-stimulate that. And the sound of warfare, right? I mean, in terms of, you know, armies used to, in the previous centuries, used to march with, you know, with drums, and, you know, you have sounding the retreat as well, the trumpets, the brass instrument as something that could pierce through the battle cries and stuff. And I mean, sound has always been violent, a violence. I mean, if you go back to the Bible, I mean, the classic story in Joshua, the walls of Jericho dismantled. And so, you know, sound isn't, or certainly isn't always soft. And in fact, the sound of sirens, and because that goes back again in the myths, isn't it, that siren is both the attraction, if you remember the Odysseus stories, passing through the rocks and being drawn, and he had to put wax in his ears, in the ears of his crew, and have himself tied to the mast so that he wouldn't be seduced by the beautiful singing of the sirens, and which again speaks as of all about a gendering of sound and a sort of masculine disempowering through womanly power, which is kind of, well, I mean, that's very interesting stuff. But it's interesting also that, if you like, the pleasurable side of sound has been withdrawn, has been diminished, and now when we say siren, we think of it just as a warning sign, signal, not as one of seduction. And so that mix of pleasure and violence is there in the very nature of sounding, and how it plays out well in society and in our cultures.
But
I'd like to think of it sort of changing the tack as we're coming to the end now. It's also a kind of creative it's a subject of creation as well. And I've been very struck, I mean, again, going back to the Bible, we're told that, you know, in the beginning was the Word. And I hear Word as logos, as meaning, as ratio, not necessarily as a spoken word. And so, you know, the Word is something that for the ancients was actually bringing into life, right? Mm-hmm. When you like in the magic, when you say abracadabra, by, you know, this is performative speaking, by saying it, like when we say, you are, the priest says, you are now married, the words themselves change the world, right? And if you go back in spiritual traditions, in Hinduism, and the idea of the Om mantra. The
mantra,
which according to the spiritual text in the Upanishads and so on, it's the speaking of the sound, right, that actually brings the world into being. You could say the drama of creation, right, that you're speaking the world into existence, speaking the universe into existence. And for me, that's just fantastic. That's just really exciting prospect that we have our existence, not just at the beginning of time, because this is like what brings time into existence, but that creation is an ongoing vibrating process that we can mimic, we can enunciate in the Om mantra, is something, well, it just, it's kind of a satisfying way that with your audience of participating in our being together in creation. So that's for me a pretty fundamental kind of process, really.
Maybe just one very last thing. I found this idea that actually future is anticipated by the ear and by the audio culture, not by a visual culture. So you can actually anticipate the future better by the ear than by the eye. Mm. I read it somewhere and I found this quite a good example of also this future orientedness and potentiality of soundings and
and is absolutely, there's an amazing irony that, if you like, sounding is the quickest to fade, unlike a mural or an icon or something. Yeah. It doesn't have a permanence, it needs continual propagation, but yet, because the future is something that we have to imagine, because it isn't there or isn't here yet, that sounding does that very well. I mean, this is, you know, the emotional connection that sounding has, that, you know, Plato was so fearful of, banning the poets and musicians from his rational republic, right? Well, yeah. And also Jacques Attai, in his book Noise, A Political Economy of Music, was very good on that. And that basically sound anticipates a future, that the future is formed in a non-verbal, non-rational way, in sounding, in a way that images, well, basically curtail and don't do justice.
It's always an image of the past. Yeah. You cannot make an image of, I mean, you can, but, you know, somehow the image is always already absent, and the sound is always in the presence, in the moment, evolves, it vibrates.
Yeah, and so basically, it's like the future has a kind of a long tail. It's not something that's ahead of us. It's something that we're, you know, finding. And for me, well, going back to my reggae examples, which I love so much, in dub music, in all the echo and reverb, and in one sense, in a literal sense, that's a memory from the past. But I see the echo and the reverb as being memories of the future, which we're allowing back into the present, because the future is already there for us to inhabit.
So there is a messianic dimension of sound.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yes. Messianic. Yeah, lovely.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Dusko Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Bano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Dusko Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.